From NPR and WBUR, I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. Tonight, lawmakers on the January 6th committee will gather at the Capitol for one more primetime hearing, the last scheduled hearing of the summer investigating last year's attack on the U.S. Capitol. Tonight, the central question will be, what was the president doing for 3 hours as his supporters were breaking into the Capitol to prevent the certification of the 2020 election? Congresswoman Elaine Luria, a Democrat from Virginia, serves on the committee, and she will be presenting tonight. Congresswoman, welcome back.
Thank you, Peter, for having me.
So after 7 high-profile hearings, tonight's has been described as something of a closing argument. So in a nutshell, what is your closing argument?
Well, perhaps described that way because, you know, it's sort of the final episode in what happened on January 6th. We did, you know, a whole series of hearings that led up to this point, talking about the pressure campaigns, the attempt to corrupt the Department of Justice, the call to Washington, violent extremists. And then tonight we're going to talk about what happened on that day of January 6th during that three-hour, roughly 187-minute period from the time the president finished his speech at the Ellipse. And mind you, this was a speech to a group of people who he knew were armed. He called them to Washington, D.C. For this rally. He stepped off that stage after having urged them multiple times to march to the Capitol and gave them the impression that he was going to march with them, in fact, like lead them to the Capitol. And from that moment until 4:17 in the afternoon, when he finally made remarks to the nation, essentially, you know, what one would anticipate a president to do would be very forceful, to call for, you know, a cease to the violence and, you know, to hold people accountable who'd broken the law. But he didn't do any of that.
He didn't, and he could have at any point, though. He could have at any point. So what information do you have that would explain why he did not?
Well, we have testimony, both live witnesses who are going to join us, as well as testimony from many of the people who've spoken to the committee about the events that went on in the White House that day, the actions that people around him took to try to encourage him to say the right thing, to do the right thing. And in many cases, did exactly the opposite. People might recall there was a tweet, it was at 2:24 p.m., where he kind of threw gasoline on the fire. He told, you know, everyone through this tweet that, you know, Vice President Pence doesn't have the courage to do the right thing, essentially implying that he could unilaterally overturn the results of the election. And, you know, Vice President Pence, before that, he was already at the Capitol. He put out a letter stating that he was going to follow the law, follow the Constitution, and his duty was just to read the results. And the, you know, rioters, they reacted to this tweet. You can clearly see that they were hearing what the president said. They were then turning their anger to Vice President Pence.
I want to ask you about something related to this. Your committee has been trying to get Secret Service text messages from around the time of January 6th. They have disappeared. The agency says they were lost during a system upgrade that started before they were asked to keep the data. I think at this point you might have gotten a single exchange turned over. Do you think this was an honest mistake, or do you think the Secret Service could be trying to cover something up?
I think it's very concerning. You know, there's a requirement for federal agencies to retain different types of data and records, and it's something the committee is going to continue to dig into. I'm not an IT expert, so, you know, a lot of people will say, well, can't they recover those text messages? I don't know the answer, you know, the technical answer to, you know, how that kind of process would work, but we are going to put the smartest people on that, and we're going to really work to get this evidence because, you know, it's important that we understand everything that was going on during that time period.
So you haven't given up on your effort to see them? I mean, I just wonder if it's even possible based on the technology.
I think that there's a lot of things that we don't know at this point. So we're continuing to pursue this, and it's something that we will continue to dig into more because we need answers about, you know, what happened with these text messages. You know, we want to have access to anything that would paint a clear picture of what was happening on January 6th.
Another big question, of course, is whether or not Donald Trump will be charged with a crime. During a press conference yesterday, Attorney General Merrick Garland said this.
No person is above the law in this country. I can't say it any more clearly than that. There is nothing in the principles of prosecution, in any other factors, which prevent us from investigating anyone who's criminally responsible for an attempt to undo a Democratic election.
Congresswoman, I've asked you this before, but has your position changed on the issue of whether or not the former president should be prosecuted?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly that no one is above the law, whether that is a sitting president, a former president, or someone who is potentially going to become a presidential candidate in the future. I think that, you know, through the evidence we've laid out in the committee, and there was a ruling related to some of that evidence we were collecting, and Mr. Eastman, who was part of the plot to, you know, create these false electors, to acquire his emails. There's a federal judge who's already said that there's three specific items, which include obstructing government proceedings, defrauding the U.S. government, as well as common fraud, that, you know, it was likely enough for a federal judge to say, hey, you can't have attorney-client privilege to protect these emails because it appears that a crime has occurred here. I think there's other things that could potentially, you know, be criminal within what we've, you know, discovered and laid out. But I just want to reiterate, probably as I did last time, that, you know, the committee is a legislative committee. Our goal and our purpose as members of Congress is to lay out the facts, provide recommendations to prevent something like this from happening in the future. And, you know, it really would be up to the Department of Justice, a judge and jury, yeah, essentially, to determine if there was a crime.
I have less than a minute here, but I do want to ask you a personal question. There's an election coming up. You're from a pretty conservative district for a Democrat. Do you think your work on this committee has damaged your chances of getting reelected?
You know, it's something that, you know, we'll see in November, certainly as a Democrat in a district that's Republican going into this. You know, I had the thought, like, maybe this won't be popular with people in our district, but it was one of those things where I also thought to myself, you know, frankly, I don't care, because this is so much bigger than whether Elaine Luria gets reelected. I know that I'm doing the right thing. I'm on the right side of history with this, and this is just so important that we get the facts out to the American people.
Congresswoman Elaine Luria is a Democrat from Virginia. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And sticking with Washington now, after more than 2 years dodging COVID-19, President Biden has now tested positive for the coronavirus. In a statement this morning, the White House said the president is experiencing, quote, very mild symptoms. NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid joins us now. Hey, Asma.
Hi there, Miles.
So what else can you tell us about President Biden's condition?
Well, the president is fully vaccinated, and he's also received two booster shots. But, you know, nonetheless, he is 79 years old, and so he has already begun taking Paxlovid. That's the 5-day course of medication that's used to treat the virus more effectively and quickly. And it's used, you know, particularly in people over the age of 50, people who are considered high risk. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the president will isolate, but he intends to continue carrying on his full duties during this time period. We have been told that he plans to participate in scheduled meetings via Zoom or phone from the White House residence. And the president was supposed to travel to Pennsylvania today. That, of course, has been canceled. And just a bit ago, the president's Twitter account had a photo of him sitting behind a desk saying, folks, I'm doing great. Thanks for your concern. And Biden said that he had called local officials up in Pennsylvania to send his regrets.
And Asma, how was this virus, the COVID-19 virus, detected in Biden?
Well, according to a letter issued by the president's doctor, the virus was detected as part of just a routine screening through a rapid antigen test, and then it was subsequently confirmed via a PCR test. You know, Miles, I will say this comes, of course, you know, as the country is facing yet another wave of COVID, just with the BA5 subvariant. And it is true that Biden has managed to dodge this virus for a long time, but it is also true that he has been, you know, going out more and more with people, handshaking, back slapping, both here domestically and then, of course, in the Middle East. I was just on that trip with him, and there was a lot of physical interaction without masks.
So, you mentioned that they were not wearing masks recently, but I'm curious about how this COVID bout from the president compares to, I think we all remember when former President Trump got COVID about a month before the 2020 election. I was actually on Air Force One talking to former President Trump while he wasn't wearing a mask at that same week. How does this kind of current COVID bout compare to that time?
You know, Trump was in very serious shape when he got the coronavirus. And I will say, we didn't really know about it in real time. It's some of the reporting that we've seen subsequently that I think gave us a clearer picture of just how ill the former president was. The Biden team has tried to contrast itself with offering additional transparency. They say that they will be providing daily updates, which, you know, the Trump team did as well, but they weren't incredibly forthcoming. We are expecting a briefing from the White House shortly this afternoon, so we'll see how much additional detail we'll get from that. But I do think, Miles, ultimately, it is important to keep in mind that we as a country are at a fundamentally different point in this pandemic than we were when former President Donald Trump got sick. You know, the science is better, people are getting vaccinated, and there are just far fewer people getting hospitalized and dying from this virus.
That's NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid.
A string of close encounters with sharks recently on both coasts have left beachgoers and officials worried. Some of New York City's most popular beaches have closed, and in a way, it's good timing for Discovery Channel's long-running summer series Shark Week, which starts on Sunday. The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, is this season's host. Johnson has deep family ties to Samoa, where sharks are revered. In this ad promoting the series, he's seen looking down on a cove full of them.
How many sharks did we say we needed?
Well, our next guest also reveres sharks. He's been dubbed Shark Week's biggest critic. David Schiffman is a marine conservation scientist whose new book is called Why Sharks Matter, a deep dive with the world's most misunderstood predator. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And I was surprised to see that Shark Week actually took up a fair amount of space in your book. Why do you want people to think twice about it?
Well, the biggest issue that I and many of my scientific colleagues have with Shark Week is that it's a missed opportunity. It's a great idea. It's measurably and has been measured the largest increase in Americans paying attention to any ocean science or conservation issue of the whole year, and they fill it with just nonsense. Sometimes it's harmful nonsense. Sometimes it's just useless nonsense. But Shark Week is an enormous missed opportunity, and there are several large-scale public misunderstandings about shark behavior and conservation that can be traced directly back to Shark Week.
I'm thinking of one of them. Several years ago, the series aired a program suggesting that the prehistoric giant shark known as the Megalodon was still alive. And I understand that people threatened you for trying to debunk that.
Yes, so that was certainly a low point in a series that has had a lot of low points. If you've ever been at a science museum or aquarium and they have those giant jaws you can stand in and take a picture, that's Megalodon. The claim that Shark Week made was not just that Megalodon is still alive, but that scientists and the government know that and are lying to you, and you should not trust scientists or the government.
So what kind of damage does that misinformation do? And also not just the Megalodon, but sort of all the other programs on Shark Week that that describe these animals as monsters or lurking in the deep. You know, what does that do for folks like you who are trying to help them?
Well, sharks are an incredibly misunderstood and also an incredibly threatened group of animals. The latest numbers from the IUCN Red List show that about 1 in 3 known species of sharks and their relatives are considered threatened with extinction. And the number one cause by far is us. We need to change our laws. We need to change how we interact with the ocean, or we're in danger of losing many shark species forever. And when Shark Week doesn't talk about that, but instead has the guys from Jackass get launched through a cannon into a feeding frenzy of sharks and one of them gets bitten, that is time not being spent focusing on real things that really matter. And I'm not saying that every documentary television series has to be a dry, boring, stuffy science lecture, but it should talk about real things that are really important and talk about them in a way that's not full of lies.
You know, we heard Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, there at the top of this segment. He is going to be Shark Week's Master of Ceremonies. And you know, it's interesting because he came out and said how happy he is to be doing that because sharks are sacred to the Polynesian culture. I wonder if maybe Shark Week is starting to get the message and that maybe this is an olive branch of some kind?
Certainly, he's an appropriate host, and he is sort of universally beloved as celebrities go. I'm a big fan of his. He's a University of Miami alum. That's where I got my PhD. So very happy to see him involved here. But they still have plenty of nonsense involved. And some of the celebrities that they use are not so wholesome. One particularly jarring conversation I remember on social media a few years ago is when I was talking about maybe they shouldn't have had Mike Tyson fight a shark underwater as part of what's supposed to be nonfiction educational programming.
This time of year, summertime, people are at the beach. You just watch the news, and maybe this is part of the problem, too. We hear stories like this one from Fox News about several recent shark encounters off Long Island, New York.
This is the fourth shark attack, Sandra, in less than 2 weeks. It happened around 7:30 this morning out there in Suffolk County.
So, David, you don't actually use the phrase shark attack, although in some cases it does seem like the word fits. But why?
So when you hear the word shark attack, what you picture is Jaws. You picture a malicious monster stalking the beach and planning and willfully causing mayhem and destruction. But a lot of what's reported as shark attacks in I'm using sarcastic air quotes. I realize you can't see that on radio interview, but very sarcastic air quotes with my fingers, is not that. The shark bumps a person. The shark swims near a person in a way that the person finds threatening but does not physically touch them. And that leads to this perception that sharks are bad and sharks are dangerous and sharks are scary. And sure, the injuries do happen, and every once in a while a shark does even kill someone. But there are so many things that kill more people than sharks that you don't think of as dangers. Flower pots falling on your head as you walk down the street kill more people than sharks. As a social media guy, I love this one that more people die in a typical year falling off cliffs trying to take a selfie of the beautiful scenery than are killed by sharks. But you don't get fear-mongering media coverage of this that says we need to kill all the cliffs.
Hmm. Well, in fact, maybe it's the humans that are dangerous for sharks. How many sharks do people kill every year in the oceans?
So the best estimate we have, which is a very, very back-of-the-envelope estimate, is about 100 million sharks a year. And that number, it sounds big and scary. It doesn't necessarily mean anything without context. But there are certainly too many sharks are being killed by humans due to unsustainable overfishing practices, both intentionally targeting sharks for both their fins and their meat, and accidentally through bycatch, which is accidentally catching a shark when you're trying to catch a tuna or something that's near the sharks.
Lose 100 million of anything, I feel like you have a problem in the ecosystem. What does that mean for the oceans?
So sharks are really important animals in terms of keeping the oceans and our coastal ecosystems healthy. They keep the food web in balance. And when we're talking about the ocean, that's a series of food webs that provides food for billions of humans, including many of the poorest humans on Earth, and provides jobs for tens of millions of humans. So when we start destabilizing the ocean, it is bad news, not just for the environment, but for us.
Hmm. Are there sharks around in the ocean whenever you swim? I mean, should we just assume that's the case? And if so, what should we think about that? How should we think about that?
If you have ever been in the ocean, there probably was a shark not that far from you. It knew you were there. Their senses, and especially the sense of smell, but other senses too, are legendary. Just because you don't see a shark doesn't mean a shark doesn't see you. And most of the time, they leave you alone. I've been swimming with sharks all over the world, and most of the photos I have are of sharks swimming away from me really fast, because that's normally what they do when they see a person. If you go in the ocean and you see a shark, and it's just minding its own business, you do not need to be worried. If you go in the ocean, there's probably a shark near you minding its own business that you don't even see. And these scaremongering, fearmongering news stories and documentaries on Shark Week, like Sharkpocalypse and Shark Explosion and all that nonsense, is certainly not helping with our ability to understand and perceive risk.
So, David, how many of the misperceptions about these animals started in 1975 when Peter Benchley's film Jaws came out and scared the heck out of people when they went to the beach?
Yeah, Jaws has had such a profound transformative effect on how the world thinks about a topic that we actually have something called the Jaws effect in the public policy literature. Before Jaws, most people who went to the beach didn't really think about sharks that much. And now lots of people tell me they're terrified of going in the water, even up to the ankle depth water, because of sharks. My parents told me the summer that Jaws came out, they didn't want to go swimming in their community pool. It absolutely transformed the way that people think about the ocean and sharks and our place on the food chain.
I laugh at your parents saying they don't want to go into the pool only because I can relate, kind of. Actually,
yeah.
No, it's amazing. Yeah, very powerful film. David Schiffman, a marine conservation scientist whose new book is called Why Sharks Matter, A Deep Dive with the World's Most Misunderstood Predator. David, thank you so much for this. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, come on. You knew we had to do it. That score from the film may be the reason why David's parents were so afraid to go into the pool. And I'll be honest, it plays in my head whenever I'm swimming pretty much anywhere that's not a pool. The Jaws theme is by John Williams, and we asked film music historian John Burlingame to explain why it is so good.
When Steven Spielberg made Jaws, he had all kinds of problems during the shoot. You know, the shark didn't work half the time, one thing after another. And what he needed was a score that was going to make this movie work. And it was then really up to John Williams to figure out how to make sure the audience understood that this was a terrifying, death-creating machine coming after you that you could not stop. And so his concept was this whole idea of this sort of rumbling in the lower bottom half of the orchestra with the lowest strings and the lowest brass instruments playing this dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And Spielberg tells a funny story about how when it was first presented to him as an idea, he started to laugh because he thought John was making a joke. But in fact, John had discovered a signature for this eating machine under the water. Film historians cite Jaws as one of the most terrifying scores ever written. Williams really knew what he was doing, and he wrote this fairly simple orchestral idea and then made it work over the course of 2 hours, so much so that now you can just play that music and people run screaming from the beach.
Film music historian John Burlingame spoke to our producer, Lynn Menegon, who loves a good shark tale more than just about anyone at the beach. Amazon is making another big move in healthcare. The company will spend nearly $4 billion to buy One Medical, a small but growing primary care practice. Robin Farzad joins us now. He's going to talk about it. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, One Medical offers concierge healthcare. What does a company like Amazon want with that?
Amazon can want whatever the heck it wants at this point. Look, it shelled out $14 billion in cash for Whole Foods, $9 billion for MGM. This would be its third biggest acquisition, but is anybody even keeping count anymore? We have to remember that Amazon is galactic. It has a $1.3 trillion market cap, and the other trillion-dollar number you need is the healthcare economy. $4 trillion the United States spend on healthcare. So if you're someone like Andy Jassy, the new CEO, you want to take a gigantic whack at this pinata.
I guess we should probably ask if it's good for medicine, though. I mean, good for healthcare.
That's very up in the air. Is Amazon good for retail? Is Amazon good for consumers? Would you say Amazon Prime has, on balance, been good for America and the worker and the like? That's a whole other question, a whole other can of worms. But that's the appeal in it. They have such a membership database that imagine if the email goes out that we're thinking about launching something akin to Amazon Prime Healthcare, do you think that the majority of their users wouldn't be interested? So to the extent they could pick up something like this for about $4 billion, that it's a primary care clinic operator, maybe it's a foot in the door to bolt in with their other businesses like PillPack and gradually build out capability like we have seen during the pandemic with telehealth and online pharmacies. That's kind of grown by leaps and bounds.
You mentioned PillPack, so we need to say that this is just the latest leap that Amazon has taken into healthcare. And you also rightly point out that there's a lot of money in this big industry. So just remind us real quick what else Amazon has done in that industry.
Yeah, there's the online pharmacy PillPack that it bought 2 years ago. So that helped it launch its own pharmacy business. Obviously, you can't do everything that you can do at a CVS or Walgreens over on Amazon, but you could get prescriptions to a certain extent, clearly some over-the-counter goods that link to your HSA. So Amazon has capability there. But the idea here is that if you could start with a chat and a virtual visit with a healthcare professional, as the Wall Street Journal reports, that could be consummated with the prescription delivery to a home, which Amazon, we know, has distribution and logistics, if nothing else.
So do you think, I mean, are you saying that Amazon has the opportunity to do some healthcare innovation here?
In theory, because as we know, it is brutally difficult to kind of disentangle. I mean, this is a very protected industry. You look at United Healthcare, you look at the pharmaceuticals since Obamacare was ratified, and they've done quite well, thank you. And you're going to have to pry a lot of this business from their cold, dead hands. And it's much easier said than done. But look, Amazon gets the license to do it in retail. Can it be done in healthcare? That is really a $4 trillion question.
Well, and are people going to be willing to go along with it? If I'm a doctor or if I'm a potential patient, I may see, Amazon come into this space and say, no, thanks, I'm not going anywhere near that. This is medicine we're talking about.
That's right. But I also, you know, can walk into a Costco and buy a casket with a lot of whiskey and wine and crab salad, right? The membership is supposed to have its benefits. And we never thought that Amazon Prime would mean what it does today. And who knows what it's going to have to look like in 10 years to justify whatever it's going to be, $1,000 a year?
All right. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate it.
The race to replace Boris Johnson as Britain's prime minister is now down to two. Former Chancellor Rishi Sunak and incumbent Foreign Secretary Liz Truss are vying to become the next leader of the Conservative Party. To do that, they'll need to win a majority of the party's members. So who are these two finalists, and how will this race shape up? Peter Cardwell is political editor for Talk Radio in the UK and a former advisor to four cabinet members. He joins me now. Hey, Peter.
Hi there.
So tell us a little bit about this contest up to this point. We started with 11 members of parliament hoping for the leadership spot. How did we get down to these two?
Well, there's a contest that meant that all 11 entered. They needed to get a number of nominations, and then it went down to the final two. They were knocked out one by one, sort of like Agatha Christie's, and then there were none novel, except there are two by the end of it. Rishi Sunak, the finance minister, the chancellor, he was until about 2 weeks ago before he resigned, and Liz Truss, who is the foreign secretary or our secretary of state, essentially. So two very senior politicians here in the United Kingdom.
So let's learn a little bit more about these two. We'll start with Sunak, who won the most votes among Conservative members of Parliament this week. If he's elected, he would become the UK's first non-white prime minister. Here he is speaking at a TV debate a few days ago, laying out his economic strategy.
I'd love to stand here and say, look, I'll cut this tax, that tax, and another tax, and it will all be okay. But you know what? It won't. There's a cost to these things, the cost of higher inflation, higher mortgage rates, eroded savings. And you know what? This something-for-nothing economics isn't conservative, it's socialism.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Sunak and how he got to this point?
He's a really interesting character. He comes from a very ordinary background. His mother was a pharmacist, his father a general practitioner, local doctor, and then he married into a very rich Indian family. His wife, Akshata Murthy, is actually richer than the Queen. So one of the big criticisms of Rishi Sunak is that in the cost of living crisis that the UK is currently experiencing, that many people don't feel he can really connect with them or identify with them. But I worked a little bit with Rishi Sunak when he was the local government minister in one of the departments that I worked in. And I know that he's an incredibly intelligent person. He's a Fulbright scholar, and he's someone who really has a very Atlanticist approach. I think he'd be a good friend to America. But also he's been through the very tough times economically here in the UK, not just the cost of living crisis, but dealing with COVID as well. And we had a furlough scheme that was a £408 billion put into the economy to save people's jobs. So he is saying quite a tough message actually on tax, quite a difficult message to say that he's not going to immediately cut taxes, but wants to in the medium term. And I think that is something that's going to be quite difficult for him to get through. But certainly he has risen quite quickly as a parliamentarian. He's someone who certainly resonates a lot with many parts of the Conservative Party. But I think that Liz Truss, certainly there's a poll out literally in the last few hours that says she has a 24-point lead over him. So she is certainly the favourite.
So let's listen to a little bit of Liz Truss. She's been described as somewhat of a Boris Johnson loyalist. Here she is at the same debate as Sunak last week.
I'm somebody who says what I think. I'm honest. I was brought up in Yorkshire. I say what I mean, and I mean what I say. And I'm somebody that when I promise to deliver something, I do deliver it.
And so what's Truss's path been to get to this point, you know, being this close to becoming prime minister?
She has had a number of roles within the UK cabinet. Unlike America, you can move around different portfolios. So she's been the Justice Secretary, she's been the Environment Secretary, and she's been the Foreign Secretary. So she's someone who has a lot of experience. Also, she was International Trade Secretary, and that is something post-Brexit that she wants to use to burnish her credentials, talking about the number of trade deals that she has signed with many countries right around the world. She's someone who has a pretty radical economic plan. She wants tax cuts immediately. The International Monetary Fund say that's not the best idea, but she is someone who feels that that is the right path, and she's way ahead at the moment, 24-point lead over Rishi Sunak.
All right, so we will check in with you, Peter Cardwell, either way over the next couple weeks to see how this race turns out. That's Peter Cardwell. He's a former advisor to four cabinet ministers and political editor for Talk Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, every town or city has its favorite neighborhood go-to destinations. They're the places that locals say you just gotta try if you're in for a visit. Well, in Tupper Lake in upstate New York, there's the Washboard Donut Shop. It's a spot where you can get a fresh donut and do your laundry 7 days a week. North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell takes us there.
Tina Merrihue has been making fresh fried donuts for more than 30 years. She says it's a skill she's had to work to perfect.
Actually, it's not as easy as it looks.
Merrihue is behind the counter of the Washboard Donut Shop in the small town of Tupper Lake. In her red and black flannel shirt, she picks up a big stainless steel funnel. It's called a hopper, and it's full of donut batter. To release the batter, you push down the handle at the top, but not for too long.
It's all in the pressure of the hopper. You know, you can't hold it unless they come out fat. So it's sort of a quick punch.
With each little punch, the perfect amount of batter plops into the hot oil. Merrihue watches closely as the donuts bubble and fry.
So see how they're all popping open? And you just flip them.
She grabs a pair of long wooden tongs, each flip revealing a beautiful golden donut. After a few more minutes, she takes them out to let them cool. You can order a donut just the way it is, old-fashioned, or with frosting that Merrihue makes here herself.
There's raspberry, blueberry, strawberry. The chocolate is sort of like a real thick brownie chocolate, so I do mix a little bit of vanilla in with it.
There's also peanut butter, maple bacon, and the latest addition, Oreo cookie. The front door swings open, and a customer orders a half dozen donuts.
And I need two cinnamon sugar.
Jane St. Louis is from Tupper Lake. I ask her how often she comes in for donuts.
Oh, probably every other month or so. Depends if there's a birthday or not.
Is this for a party?
No, this is because it's Friday and we deserve a treat.
For some folks, the Washboard Donut Shop is a place to indulge, maybe while doing laundry in one of the shop's washing machines. For others, like Suzanne Orlando, it's part of a routine. Orlando owns a motel in Tupper Lake.
We come every day because these are the best donuts for in the whole North Country. And our customers love having something local and fresh every morning.
That is the key to this donut shop's success, says Ed Fletcher, that reliability. Fletcher is Tina Merrihue's father. He's owned the place for more than 30 years. Their customers, Fletcher says, can always count on them.
They always know we're here. You know, do their laundry, have a donut, have a sandwich, or go in the store 7 days a week.
That store he's referring to is a little gift shop that Fletcher opened in here years ago. He's also expanded the laundromat portion of the shop and ramped up their donut-making capacity. Fletcher says that's really where the profit is, in bulk donut orders.
Like yesterday, some lady came in and she bought, I think there was 10 dozen. That's what we need.
They also need foot traffic, people coming downtown for one thing, and then deciding also to get donuts or something from the gift shop. That's been tougher in recent years, with storefronts sitting empty or businesses just not staying open consistently. That wasn't always the case in Tupper Lake. Fletcher grew up here. He remembers when downtown was a lot more alive.
In the 50s, you'd come down here at night and all the stores were open. There used to be four or five restaurants right here on Main Street.
Fletcher and others in Tupper Lake say they are seeing a bit of a resurgence. Younger people are moving in, trying to build businesses here. There's a new housing project planned. Fletcher is hopeful about the planned rail trail that will connect Tupper Lake to Lake Placid. His daughter, Tina, says they'll be here through it all. She's confident the Washboard Donut Shop offers something special.
I think the uniqueness of people seeing me make them, being fresh, making them up as they order. Yeah, it's just unique.
Do you like donuts?
I do, but I limit myself. Especially when they're warm and rolled in the cinnamon. That's like the best.
Of course, I have to fact check her on that. So I order one, a freshly fried donut, still soft and warm, rolled in cinnamon sugar.
So good.
For Here and Now, I'm Emily Russell.
At long last, Comic-Con International is back. After 2 years of virtual gatherings and a very scaled-down conference in November, the superfans, the costumes, the movie stars, they're in full force at the San Diego Convention Center this week. Jack Smart is there, too. He's senior film writer for the AV Club. Jack, welcome.
Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. And so for those of us who have never been to or maybe don't know much about Comic-Con, what's it like, especially this year after such a long break for the pandemic?
Yeah, especially after 2 years of virtual editions of Comic-Con, it does feel like excitement is higher than ever at this one. It sort of remains to be seen whether attendance levels will be at the same as it was in 2019. Yesterday was just preview day, so I didn't see the full extent of the costuming. That will be in effect today, and I think that's where we can see the real enthusiasm. And they will all have masks. I guess it remains to be seen which of the masks will be coordinated with the costumes.
Really? Okay, masks for COVID. I know you haven't seen a lot of the costumes yet, but people love to do cosplay at this convention. Based on what you know about kind of what's popular in the culture right now, who do you expect to be the most popular, characters depicted at this Comic-Con?
Oh, yeah. I mean, DC and Marvel rule here. They are the two kind of tent poles of all of pop culture at the moment, so you can expect to see mutants and Marvel superheroes and maybe Black Adam, which is the next big DC universe feature film.
With
I don't know.
Rock.
I'm trying to think of what is the lowest maintenance costume that that certain people might show up in. It remains to be seen what will be the most popular.
What about you? Do they let the journalists dress up?
You know, I was wondering the same thing. Generally, the journalists do not dress up. I think if you throw on a Spock ear here or a Pikachu hat there, that's very welcome for getting in the spirit of things. But otherwise, no, not so much.
All right. Well, one of the big draws at Comic-Con are the panels. And this is when filmmakers and stars, they unveil the previews for their upcoming projects. Let's talk about one of them. This is the upcoming Rings of Power series on Amazon Prime. Here's part of the trailer.
It is over.
You have not seen what I've seen.
I have seen my share.
You have not seen what I have seen.
Drama. That's based on the Lord of the Rings series. It's got the elves and the dwarves and the hobbits and the big battles. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, I mean, as a big J.R.R. Tolkien fan, I'm excited that there's another big mainstream project. I believe the most expensive film production in history. It seems that because of the prominence of Peter Jackson's film trilogy, which won, of course, a bunch of Academy Awards and dominated the box office, that enthusiasm for Tolkien hasn't really waned, and I think that this TV show is sort of an example of that. Although it should be noted, it's not affiliated really in any way with Peter Jackson's movie trilogies, and is instead based on several of the prequels to The Fellowship of the Ring and The Hobbit. A lot of Tolkien's earlier works are being adapted, and I believe with the blessing of Tolkien's estate.
Hmm. So without Peter Jackson involved, we'll see if this one is quite as good. Now, it also seems like one of the most anticipated panels will be with Marvel Studios. We might get some news about the Black Panther sequel, is that right?
Correct. And in fact, it was in 2018 that the first Black Panther film screened the first ever footage for an audience. And that really kind of kicked off enthusiasm for that first film. And yeah, the next big Marvel Studios feature film will be the second Black Panther film. And I got to say, there's just a lot of confusion and I guess excitement, but also kind of tinged with sadness about the passing of the late actor Chadwick Boseman, who played T'Challa, Black Panther. That sort of leaves it up for grabs as to how they take the franchise into any which direction. Presumably, it's this weekend here at Comic-Con that possibly with cast members or the filmmakers here telling us what's going on, that we get a sense of Marvel's next big hit.
Hmm. Another panel that the AV Club singled out is one that you're looking forward to. Season 4 of FX, What We Do in the Shadows. It's like a goofy comedy about vampires. Here's a clip from the trailer.
We want the drinks to be very expensive, so then we attract rich humans. Rich humans are basically like Vale. Conceptually repulsive, but so buttery on my tongue.
I wasn't expecting that. That's funny. What do we need to know about this one?
That's so great that you were... thank you so much for highlighting this show of all the other shows being featured at Comic-Con. Jemaine Clements' vampire documentary is based on the film of the same name that he made with Taika Waititi back in the day. It's now become this critically acclaimed and I think, you know, fervent fan base as well, comedy on FX. And the fourth season is underway, so I suspect that this panel and this excitement will be more around seeing the cast and possibly seeing some upcoming footage, but that's all about to air.
All right. Jack Smart is in San Diego for Comic-Con, which is back after a pandemic hiatus. Senior film writer at the AV Club, thank you very much. I hope you can find your Pikachu hat in your luggage.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.